Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. He's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known back to the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Little known fact about my guest today, like so many others who've been on this podcast, stars of stage and screen and television, so many of them found their community and their home at theater camp. It saved them, it inspired them, it created their first family that became their inspiration and support system as they went forward in a life in the arts in earnest. And today's guest, director Gordon Greenberg, is no exception. Welcome, Gordon Greenberg, to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey, everyone. My guest today is Gordon Greenberg. Gordon has directed on Broadway, off Broadway, in London's West End. He's written for television and the stage. He's currently represented on Broadway as the director of The Heart of Rock and Roll and recently directed the off-Broadway production of Dracula, a comedy of terrors. He also directed on the Broadway Holiday Inn, the new Irving Berlin musical. His acclaimed revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, starring Calista Flockhart and Zachary Quinto, won the Los Angeles Drama Critics Award for Best Revival. And he directed the revival of Guys and Dolls on the West End. As an actor, he performed on Broadway as well in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, Grease, and The Little Prince and The Aviator. Gordon is a teacher. Gordon is a guest lecturer. Gordon has so many different things in development right now. It's ridic. I am so happy to have my old friend, Gordon Greenberg, on the podcast. Welcome, Broadway director. How are you?
Thank you, star. I'm so happy to see you.
I can't believe
it. It's been
way
too long. We were just talking about that. But I do love that we're still in the same orbit and still have the same friends and hopefully an expanded and enlightened version of the same interests.
I know that... First of all, The Heart of Rock and Roll, let's start with it. I'm scared that I have so many questions about, like, from the day you were born until today, that this Huey Lewis musical will somehow not get its due. So I just want to talk a little bit about The Heart of Rock and Roll and how you and your good friend Huey Lewis, as you would describe him to folks now, how do you work with someone like him? Did you just have to get permission and then bring the whole thing back to him? Did he collaborate along the way with you? Sort of what was the process of making this leave the station in the way that it has?
Interestingly, the first version of this sort of came to me in a nascent, you know, kind of scratch form. And it had a sense that it wanted to be a John Hughes film of a Broadway show. I knew the music was sensational and every single song was a bop. And it had that quality that ABBA songs have, but you may or may not realize how many of them you know, and that it just makes you feel good instantly. So I believed in the overall idea of the project, but I knew it was going to take a while to kind of percolate and find itself. So the first place we went was the Old Globe in San Diego. We brought on the terrific Brian Usifer, who's behind me. He is waving. It was a great sort of overall music supervisor, arranger, orchestrator, and started playing with different ways to hear songs that were familiar that made them even more theatrical and exciting and funny and cheeky. And when we went to the Old Globe, we were working with the fantastic Barry Edelstein, who is very smart dramaturgically. I mean, his background of running Shakespeare in the Park in New York is kind of unparalleled. And he loved this. He just had a soft spot for this music. It was really interesting. And we were looking for a theater to develop it at. We did kind of our first reading, and we had offers from everyone, from Williamstown to like very sort of heady places, that said, this is guilty pleasure, but it's quality, and it has a truth and a soulfulness at its center. And that's really what we've worked to do, is to maintain the soul at its center, but keep it fun and as a delivery system for joy and ebullience and joie de vivre, as they say.
Can I ask you something? I mean, I think people and shows go through the development process. There's no every story is unique in terms of how a show is created. In this case, you were with it from the beginning. You were not brought a musical that had been written to you to direct. You were a part of the process from the beginning, or somewhere in the middle?
Somewhere in the middle, really. I think, I mean, if you want like the nuts and bolts, I think the original producer from LA, Tyler Mitchell, who works with Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, had never produced a Broadway show. And he called William Morris, my agents, and they sent him 10 different people, and everyone interviewed, and I got the job. So that was, you know, pretty straightforward. And it rarely happens like that, where there are actual interviews for directors, kind of like you would have for actors for a job. But it happened. And I think at that point, I would venture to say that he and the terrific Jonathan Abrams, who's the book writer, who's got a big movie coming out now, Clint Eastwood just directed his film Juror Number Two, because theater was new to them, I'm not sure they anticipated that it would be 10 years before we are finally on Broadway. But there were many, many hoops, hurdles, readings, workshops, productions, differences of opinions, discoveries, so many unexpected roller coaster rides. But that's kind of what it takes to develop something new and something that has enough interest and an idea every 10 seconds that will keep you engaged. And then at the end of it, to feel like you've had a worthwhile experience, which is the interesting thing. Sometimes in a film, you can always go back and edit. We have to do a whole nother reading.
It's insane. It's insane. And is Huey Lewis involved, or does he just show up as an audience member?
Huey has been incredibly involved, and the right amount. You know, he gives us space to create and then comes in and at another level will give terrific notes and a sense of values that he's missing, a lyric that sounds strange to him that sometimes we may have to work our way back to make sure it all makes sense. But he's been with us. I'm sure you're aware that sadly, when we started production 6 years ago in San Diego, he was diagnosed with Meniere's disease, which is a significant loss of hearing. So he had to cancel his tours and stop performing. So this became kind of a focus for him and a way to secure his legacy. And although he can no longer hear pitch, actually, he participates, he knows the music so well. He wrote one new song with Brian Usifer called Be Someone, which is kind of the I want song that propels the hero's journey in our show. And he loves this. This is a labor of love for him. And if you happen to have seen The Greatest Night in Pop that's on Netflix, which if you haven't, I highly recommend it. But when you see it, you'll understand the kind of generosity of spirit and humor and kind of every man, no ability, but eminence of Huey Lewis. And we really tried to infuse the show and the process with that same sensibility.
I did Judge Wasta. That is an incredible, that is the most satiating documentary about
it's
such
so
a
crazy.
Specific.
Did you cry?
The whole
I cried when they sang Deo.
It's incredible. And also, like, having, you know, in the last year, lost Harry Belafonte, and also people's legacies have changed since that night in all sorts of ways. And just seeing who's kind of survived it and who's kind of continued to make new music. And Billy Joel, who's still playing all that music and selling out Madison Square Garden on the daily if he wanted to. It's just all of it. And Cyndi Lauper, everybody. It's just incredible. That I could talk about that for the next hour. And showing it to my kids, and I'm like, do you not understand who, like, imagine Taylor Swift, and like, who would be in the room now that would blow their minds in that
That's
way?
A good question. Yeah. But it would be Beyonce, Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Still Bruce Springsteen.
still a lot of those people. And, you know, just Quincy Jones. Just Quincy Jones. Just the mind that is Quincy Jones. That's a whole other...
I have to say, as a director, I was watching his expert navigation of what could have been a minefield there. Yeah. A lot of egos.
Personalities. A lot of personalities. And numbers, right? I didn't see a stage manager, who are the heroes of what we do on Broadway, you know, wrangling everyone. All right, but we digress. I want to just say, first of all, congratulations. This is not officially your Broadway debut. You did the Irving Berlin musical.
Yes, Holiday Inn, I co-wrote and directed. This I'm just directing.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're doing the thing that people dream of doing, and then you are doing 1 million other things at the same time. Like, your resume is so jam-packed. You know, if you're an Andy Cohen fan, there's a project that Gordon Greenberg was involved in terms of bringing Andy's book to screen. I don't know if that has gotten stopped in the pipeline of development.
It's in that pipeline that we all know very well.
Yes. But can you just talk a little bit, because Bravo has taken over the universe. My two worlds are Broadway and Bravo, if I'm really honest of what I ingest as a human. How does one, regardless of whether the Andy Cohen show happens or not, how does one take a book that Andy Cohen wrote and develop it into a TV show? And what was that process like?
Well, the first pitch for it, my first pitch to Jason Blum,
producer,
who happens to be Jason Blum, is a friend of mine, who was also friendly with Andy. And I said, let's do Everyone Hates Chris for Andy Cohen. And it'll be about Andy planning his bar mitzvah and sort of figuring out he's gay and all the crazy characters around him in the 80s. If you can tell, I love the 80s, which is where we're living for this show as well.
I love it. I'm so happy for you.
And then I know we get to live in our happy place for a while, until six. And then you go home. But when we brought it to Andy, he was very interested. And Jason, you know, is a fair guy. And he said, we love it up here. Now take this, develop it from the ground up, and put it through the whole pipeline.
Like, what does it really look like? Like, what?
Yes.
Like,
what? So then we had to get granular. Yeah. And I co-wrote it with Michael Weiner, who's a TV writer and a co-writer that I've worked with on other projects, and Todd Holland, who's one of the creators of. He worked on Malcolm in the Middle. And he was on that Dan Savage show, The Real O'Neills, was it called? I think.
With Martha Plimpton?
Great.
Yeah.
Yes. I love that show.
Show.
I thought it was so clever, but he has that, intelligence and wit, and sharpness and another perspective, because I'm not a TV director. And the three of us spent almost a year developing it, running it up the ladder at Blumhouse and then up the ladder at NBC. They bought it. It was Susan Rovner. And then the pandemic happened. Susan Rovner got replaced, as it happens. These are cyclical things. It was not a surprise. And so then it kind of sits and we figure out where it goes next. But it was a wonderful process. And the book, by default, sort of got absorbed into it. I think his team had for a long time been looking for a way to develop his book. And it's wide ranging. It starts when he's a kid and it goes all the way up until he's an adult, almost, you know, with the housewives. So you kind of have to zero in on one particular part of his life.
Right.
And everyone embraced it and said, let's call this Most Talkative and let's officially make it based on a book. And Andy was the narrator, in the pilot, at least, sort of describing moment to moment what's happening to him in retrospect. But he's a great character. It's a Ferris Bueller kind of, you know, meets Truman Capote, although he doesn't love that comparison because he has all his swans around him. That's how he always was.
Yeah. And he's a new, well, he's become a global celebrity, but he really is, you know, he walks
so
down
New York.
7th Avenue and
he's
waves
so
to
New
everybody
York.
And he embraces his own celebrity with tremendous ease and joy.
He embodies everything that is New York, which is ironic because he's from St. Louis.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is why it's a great story. And it's listen. And where did you grow up?
I grew up north of the city in a suburb called New City, which is in Rockland County near Nyack. And the road that I lived on, I didn't know this till years later when I was in college studying drama, but it's called South Mountain Road. And that's where Maxwell Anderson, the playwright, lived and wrote the play South Mountain. A High Tour is the next mountain. He also wrote a play called High Tour. And Kurt Vile lived on our road, Henry Varnum Poor. So it was, I think, probably back in the 1930s, before the George Washington Bridge, when it was, even though it's only 20 miles away,
right.
it was
remote
distance.
Somehow.
Yeah. It might have been, you know, upstate.
I have had many people on this podcast who went to Stage Door Manor. That camp, that theater camp, is so... it's just so important to them in their development as people, in terms of the friends they made, in their somehow ability to stay in it, in this business, even when it got hard because of those friendships made. Jonathan Mark Sherman and Josh Charles. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And you are one of those people. There are people from your generation, then, you know, there's Beanie Feldstein and others who, you know, are right. A little younger coming up, but it really, there's something about that place, theater camp, that is both parodied on film and television, but lived experience for you. Can you talk a little bit about that? And because I feel like somehow Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the production you did in LA, doesn't happen if you're not a kid at Stage Door Manor. Like there's a direct...
For sure. There,
yes.
There's
so,
a direct line from Stage Door Manor to
yes,
Edward Albee.
Yes, 100%.
At the time, I should say, my parents wouldn't let me go until after my bar mitzvah because they thought it would make me gay. And they were right. Yeah, it did.
But, damn it. Right again.
All those years of sports camp didn't work. But I finally went and met Jonathan and Josh and Sean Levy, and that was my bunk. That was my group of friends. And it was a life raft in so many ways. It validated what we all love doing and codified it. And when you spend 6 or 7 hours a day doing something, it goes from being a hobby to a discipline. And that was one of the things they instilled. Our music teacher was Janine Tesori. So, and you know her kind of deep humanity and discipline and rigor. And that was the idea that was infused for all of us. And it's continued no matter what we do, whether it's writing, acting, talking about, watching, just being a part of the process in any way feels like a privilege to me. And the truth of the matter is, when I was a little kid, I would just have my parents photograph me under marquees for every Broadway show. I have like snapshots of me like throwing my arms up like Patti LuPone
and Tevye, both.
And exactly. Just a slight bending of the arm from one to the other. But it's to be a part of the community is, you know, something that was like beyond expectations. And Stage Door really did turn that from a fantasy into something that seemed within reach, because half the camp had either professional experience or connections. And I certainly credit it with not only teaching me that, you know, doing any of these art forms is something that requires training and hard work and thought, but also requires the nourishment and camaraderie of like-minded friends. And so many of those people are still my closest friends. You name them.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jonathan and Sean and all, I can name all of them, and I are, you know, still texting every other day and talking about what we're experiencing, because sometimes just having someone remind you that what you're doing matters, and also that it's not the only thing that matters. It's equally important.
Yeah. That's incredible. I wasn't able to see it, but from what I read and from people who were able to get out to LA, your production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was just this really beautiful reimagining, as well as like really honoring Edward Albee in the telling of this production. The story of this production. You know, Calista was someone we knew in New York, and she went to LA and suddenly was catapulted to fame with Ally McBeal, that lightning in a bottle thing that happens. Right. And then she marries Harrison Ford. Like, it just keeps going. It's so large, right? Sort of the thing that happened, and hadn't been doing a lot of plays, and, you know, certainly wasn't coming back to New York every, you know, hiatus to do something. So, and also like a private, shy person in a way, you know.
She is very, very private. And I think people imagine that she is Ally McBeal because that's what she's known for.
Yeah.
But I know her, as you do and did, as, you know, a classical actor on Broadway with a fierce power, strength to her. So it wasn't surprising to me when at Jessica's wedding, so inside.
So Jessica Queller, a mutual friend of ours, got married recently. It's such a happy love story. Jessica, you might know her work because she has written on
All the Girls, Gossip Girl.
Yes, and Supergirl. Also Supergirl. Yes, in my house, that's been generationally the one. So from superheroes to Upper East Side superheroes.
Exactly.
She's a tremendous television writer in her own right. So anyway, that's the Jessica we're talking about. And that's her wedding where this idea happened with Calista.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
We're sitting next to each other and sort of just daydreaming about what we can do, because Liam, her son, had finally gone to college and she had more bandwidth in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And we both had always wanted to work on Virginia Woolf. And I knew that she had that character in her in a very real way. And it just, all of the pieces fell into place. And I met with Zach Quinto, who loved the idea. And he is just one of my favorite new people that I've met in the last 2 years.
Amazing, yeah.
Intensely bright and hardworking and specific and loyal. And just, I can't say enough good things. He was a brilliant George. But watching her as Martha was like watching Jenna Rollins in a Cassavetes film. You know, if you look at like Charles Isherwood, I think in his, I rarely look at reviews or quote them, but I thought what he said actually articulated what we were trying to do, which is that she's trying to claw herself back to her younger iteration. Like, she is, Calista's still beautiful, but it's a woman who feels that sliding out from under her and is fiercely trying to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And what evolved quickly was a love triangle with Graham Phillips, who was playing Nick, who you probably remember from The Good Wife, who played Juliana Margulies' son. That's how young he is. It's amazing how quickly all that happened. But there was an interesting love triangle. And you saw that Calista, even when she goes to bed with him, she does not want to. She wants to be going to bed with her husband. And she just, there were so many beautiful moments in her performance. But I remember something that just happened one day in rehearsals when she was warning her husband, I'm going to do it. She knocks back a drink and starts weeping. Like, I swear I'm going to do it. And you see how badly she does not want to. She's desperate to provoke and somehow get a response out of George, but he doesn't give it to her.
Right. And that's their game. I mean, that's the power struggle in that couple.
So heartbreaking.
And they're both so good at it. They both win and lose in equal
exactly.
measure in that way. Well, that is something that needs to be done again so more people can see it when schedules align, because it killed me that I couldn't like hop on a plane and see it for whatever reason. You have also really spent a lot of time not just doing the thing you love in so many ways. I mean, you really like there's not a lane that you do not drive down creatively, but you also teach and sort of share your passion and knowledge. And is that something I talk, yesterday Cameron Manheim was on the podcast and she was talking about the in-between, which is for actors, there's a lot of in-between. And it doesn't matter if you're Calista or if you're just getting, out of high school and want to do this thing. There's not always work, or the right work. And who you are in between those jobs is just as important, if not more so, than when the work is feeding you. You started out like all of us. You were in Broadway shows. You did it. That's like for a kid at Stage Door Manor to end up in a Broadway show. You could have gone like, I've done it. I'm on the real Broad, right? How
I
did you
did.
sort of move into these other areas of creativity? And like, was that a choice or was it sort of a series of coincidences and events?
I think it's sort of, I mean, when you say the in between, it did start as something that was in between acting jobs when you're an actor. And then before you know it, your heart and soul are invested in something new, whether it's writing or producing or being a chef or whatever else you're doing that's using your creative self. And I started a long time ago an education program for Broadway, which is called the Broadway Teachers Workshop. And it brings theater teachers from all over the world to New York every summer. And they take a series of classes, master classes with everyone from Lin-Manuel Miranda. We've had Stephen Sondheim, Jonathan Mark Sherman, you name it. Everyone comes in. And they also go to see a bunch of Broadway shows and meet with the cast members. And it's a great way to make theater teachers feel like a part of the professional theater community because it is a symbiotic relationship. And to arm them with inspiration, self-confidence, and new methods to take back to their classes. Because I think it must be difficult, particularly if you're teaching somewhere more isolated, to be the only theater teacher in your school.
To be
Unlike
the only one who cares about this thing.
exactly, and it's palpable, it's big, it's powerful within you. So for them, coming to this program is like how I felt going to Stage Door. My people. And they connect. And so I've always loved doing that. And that was something that I always thought would be a temporary sideline. This is nice. I want to start it. I want to put it into the world. And then I'll go back to this. But what I quickly realized was that I don't want to only be doing one thing. And I think the cross-pollination of writing and teaching and creating and directing is a beautiful thing. And moving from TV back to theater, keeps me eternally learning. And I guess that's what fuels me personally, is to be somewhere where there's just a little bit of a handicap. I like a little bit of an incline, so that I'm always having to kind of be extra engaged. And maybe it's just my ADD that like that's a way to like force your focus.
But this is
But
better
it's
than
like
Adderall, or as good as Adderall, to be able
absolutely.
to. How does it feel to be back on Broadway? During the pandemic, which in some ways feels so long ago, and it's not, it's yesterday, and we really did not know what was going to come back, right? Would theater come back? I mean, we were just doing Zoom plays for a long time. So how does it feel? It's March 2024. You are weeks away from opening on Broadway, the show that you are directing, and what a time to do it for Huey Lewis, who really is like an American treasure. And when you described earlier what's going on with him, like all the more reason that it's such a, like what a beautiful gift to the theater goers and to him and his family specifically. Like, how do you feel?
Well, I will say, I personally, when we came back from the pandemic, was so grateful for theater again because I so missed it. I missed being in the audience. I missed being in a rehearsal room, all of it, that I started subscribing to every theater and doing things I never would have done before because I took it for granted. When I'm in London working there, I see something every day if possible, because I'm only here for a month.
Yeah.
But in New York, I just figure I can always catch something later. But I'm really trying not to do that anymore. And being back in a rehearsal room is much the same. I feel like everyone has this presence of mind, this appreciation that we are here, this moment is happening, and let's be grateful that this is what we're doing for a living, and that we have the opportunity to put something joyful and meaningful into the world that will help people's lives be a little happier, a little lighter, a little better. It's interesting because we're coming back at a time when there's an avalanche of new material opening. There are like 14 shows opening in the next two months.
It's such a full,
it's a crowded
full
time.
Schedule. Yeah.
And I think a rising tide kind of lifts all boats. Everyone is going to be more aware of what's happening in New York, what's happening creatively on Broadway. It's thrilling, the gamut of shows that are opening, from Ibsen with Jeremy Strong, which I'm dying to see, to some great pieces that are imported from the Almeida and from the National in London, and Lempicka and The Notebook. I mean, this is like every
Uncle
possible
Vanya.
Sensibility.
I mean, it's
Uncle
really,
Vanya,
yeah.
Thrilled about that. Have my tickets. But our show is the Mamma Mia amongst them. It's probably the only one that really aims to be a pleasure trip. And it has a lot of heart, and it is moving, because ultimately it's a love story, and it's also a father-daughter story. And all of these people are dealing with grief and moving on. But more than anything, it lives a foot off the ground, and it's a celebration. And it's something that I think hopefully will be healing and connecting and maybe a little bit of a balm at a trying time in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I cannot wait to see it. Before I let you go back to rehearsal, and maybe you're allowed to eat two almonds before you get back to it.
And you know I'm not eating almonds, as discussed earlier.
Can we say what your comfort food is? Tell the people what you like to eat during rehearsal of your Broadway show.
I have wanted Popeyes for weeks. I've been passing it and thinking about it, and I finally today just gave in.
Have you tried it yet? Have you had a bite?
No, because I've been talking to you, but
okay.
It's my carrot at the end of the stick.
Okay. What is a little known fact about Gordon Greenberg that you can share before we say goodbye?
Well, I wonder if it's a little known, because I think it's like on Wikipedia, but the fact that I was born in Texas seems to surprise most people. So I like to say I'm Texan. That's my little known fact.
There you go. Thank you. There's so many more things I want to talk to you about. So another time we'll get into all those other questions that I had. Thank you for coming on. Congratulations. I love seeing all the designer pictures behind your head. It's my favorite thing. I love first day of rehearsal, where everyone from every department comes in and just shares their magic with the cast and company. And congrats. Well done.
Thanks, Alana. Thank you for having me.
Of course. All right. I'll see you soon.
All right.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
I have some news. Little Known Facts is now available to watch on YouTube. Hours and hours and hours of interviews that you can see my fabulous guests. And guess what? It's called Little Known Facts with Alana Levine. Catchy, right? Anyway, head on over to YouTube and watch the podcast. And please don't forget to subscribe. Also, if you want to donate to the podcast, zero pressure. But if you want to, no donation is too big or too small. I am so grateful for you for listening. But if you want to donate, just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. Lastly, Little Known Facts is recorded in Brooklyn, New York, USA. My editor is Nicholas Klar. None of this happens without Nicholas. And the Little Known Facts theme song was composed and sung by Georgia Famusa, with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you for listening, and have an amazing day.